Tonight on Arena, John Behan Odyssey, a documentary on the Dublin artist's life and work, and a new production of Juno and the Peacock with Mark Rylance as Captain Boyle. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Here in Ireland, of course, we're always keen to keep an eye on other countries' take on Irish culture, whether it's our exasperation with the accents in Wild Mountain Time and a few other films besides, or our joy with the Oscar nomination for On Colleen Kuhn, or our surprise at the success of the BBC's Mrs. Brown's Boys. Well then, it's no surprise that when a titan of British theatre decides to take on one of the most iconic roles in the canon of Irish theatre, that Irish critical eyes are agog. Look no further than the Gielgud Theatre's production of Sean O'Casey's Juno and the Peacock, with Oscar and Olivier Award winner Mark Rylance playing Captain Boyle. No less curious, we asked writer Emma McBride to go to Juno and the Peacock for us and cast her eye across it. It's quite good to have you with us this evening, Emma. It's quite a cast that they've gathered for this. Not only double Olivia Oscar and multiple BAFTA-winning Mark Rylance. Along with them, as Juno, we have J. Smith Cameron, known to audiences as Jerry in Succession. But before we get stuck into that, just remind us of where we are in the O'Casey canon with Juno and the Peacock. What is the story he's telling us, the Boyle family?
So this is the story of the family who are living in a Dublin tenement during the Civil War, and their son has been injured in the War of Independence, has become disabled as a result. The father, Captain Boyle, is played by Mark Rylance, is a kind of a feckless, good for nothing. The family is held together by Juno. And the daughter, Mary, is the only person who's really working and earning in the family, but she's on strike at the moment. So they're all in pretty desperate circumstances, and the war is still raging on around them as the plague goes on.
And delight arrives at the door in the personage of Bentham, who's a young solicitor or lawyer who has an interest in Mary, but also finds news, or so he tells the Boyles, of a long-lost relative who's left them a fortune in a will.
Well, yes. And of course, it opens with him mentioning this cousin who gets roundly cursed by Captain Boyle before discovering that he has inherited half of his properties, at which point they all decide to go into deepest mourning, of course. And that sort of creates a spiral whereby the feckless good for nothing then starts to spend the money on tick. And everyone feels like the end of all the troubles is in sight. But of course, being O'Casey, this is not quite as easy as that.
Doesn't work out that well. As I mentioned, the cast is impressive, and I haven't even gone into some of the other players. Quite a strong Irish cast in here as well. But the production is directed by a Tony and Olivia Award winner Matthew Warkus. It's just such an extraordinary lineup that they've got together here. How does the show open? What sort of flavour is set from the very outset in this production?
Well, as you come into the auditorium, you know, it's a big old Victorian theatre, so it's quite beautiful. You go in, they have this enormous ragged red curtain, which, as the play goes on, begins to look a little bit more like a butcher shop's window. But there's also kind of musical music playing, and there's a kind of a lightness to the atmosphere, and the curtain goes up, and then you're sort of inside this big expressionistic view of the tenement, where you see the walls all the way up the back of the theatre, and then, you know, the room is just kind of worked around at the front of the stage. It's a very impressive set. It's very beautiful, and it's, you know, it's cunningly done so that when the lighting changes, it really creates different kinds of atmospheres within the space.
And I guess that expressionistic aspect of things allows the reality to be that you have both the outside world, where the Civil War is blazing, and the inside of the house, where a family is falling apart. I mean, it's genius on the part of O'Casey to do that, but it sounds as if the set picks up on it.
Yeah, the set absolutely plays into the atmosphere. And, you know, I mean, obviously everyone knows Gina and the Paycock very well. And I did it, you know, at school, like everyone else. Mm. And so, you know, when you arrive in, it does feel, it's kind of beautiful and grand, but also familiar. You know that, you know, the set designer has kind of hit the nail on the head.
No, I was taken aback at mentions of Charlie Chaplin. But I have in front of me of this on the screen Captain Boyle talking about religion, and at one point in his speech about religion saying, take the real Dublin people, for instance, they know about more about Charlie Chaplin and Tommy Mix than they do about Saints Peter and Paul. And Charlie Chaplin, obviously Mark Rylance, read that line and jumped at it.
Well, you know, this is clearly what's happened. And this is kind of the big theme of this Juno and the Paycock, is this choice that obviously Rylance and Matthew Warchus have worked together on a number of occasions, and they clearly cooked up this idea between them. And it's a bit of a wheeze, but also it has its own problems. So basically he enters and he's got a little toothbrush moustache, like Chaplin's little tramp, and his face is quite whited out, and then he proceeds to do Chaplin for the entire play. Occasionally a very drunk Chaplin, but there's lots of standing and casting sad eyes at the audience, soliciting sympathy, and especially when his wife is nagging him, there's huge kind of introduction of lots of kind of physical comedy and pratfalls, and, you know, people sticking burning pans down their trousers, and, you know, it's all very funny, and it's a really interesting view of that time where clearly that was going on in the world around them. But it does have its own problems, I think.
What are those problems, Emer?
I think the problem is that it takes away from the reality of the situation, and it makes you feel a lot of sympathy for Captain Boyle, Mark Rylance's character, which you shouldn't really feel, because, you know, O'Casey was also the child of a feckless father who ran off and left his mother to rear 13 children on her own in desperate circumstances. And this is not a sentimentalized portrait that he creates in Juno and the Paycock, and that does come into it here. And I think you feel for him, and he's constantly asking you to take his side over Juno's, and that's takes away from the real kind of awful situation that the family find themselves in, a lot of which he has created and takes no responsibility for.
Yeah, I suppose it also, I wonder, as an audience member then, do you feel somehow complicit in his fecklessness in that respect? But it also, I guess, puts it up then, the task really increased for J. Smith Cameron, who plays the role of Juno, the wife here. Just remind us, if you would, of Jerry, the character she played in Succession, first of all.
Well, you know, she plays Jerry, the kind of wily, is it second in command or a third in command, certainly, but up at the top of the tree, who's constantly, you know, involved in all the machinations in and also has a strange kind of relationship with the younger son. And, you know, I mean, she's fantastic, hilarious, cruel, kind of a beast of a character in Succession. And Juno is not that kind of character at all, is a character with much less agency and much less ability to, you know, to fight her battles in the way that Jerry does so kind of hilariously in Succession.
Yeah, I guess so. It is, the play is called Juno and the Paycock, you know, so O'Casey does give Juno precedence there, and yet one could argue that she is the one who carries the family. She is the one who carries the tragedy of this the outcome of the play itself. How is the character portrayed by J. Smith Cameron?
I think what she's doing is really wonderful. She has the most, I mean, and although we all know her from Succession, she's a long kind of illustrious career on the stage in the US, and she knows how to stand on the stage. She's not a film actor who's kind of lost in the space. She's very powerful. She's very magnetic. She has to do a lot of battle against all the physical comedy, and it makes it quite hard for her to break through as a kind of living, breathing character beyond the kind of role of nag until much later on, until all the tragedy begins to overwhelm the family. But she is, you know, she has the most extraordinary presence on stage and the most sort of wonderful face. You can just see everything happening in it. And she was a real delight, actually.
The other aspect of the play that often strikes me is, you know, Joxer and the Paycock, some people think of this play as literally being that. It's the double act. It's the double vaudevillian act, which feeds into the Charlie Chaplin choices of Mark Rylance here. Paul Hilton of Lady Macbeth and Wuthering Heights fame is playing the character of Joxer here. What about that partnership between the two men? You know, Joxer constantly in on the make, really.
Yeah, I mean, they're real, like, they are a joy to watch, whatever about the outcome for the rest of the play. Mm. The two of them on stage together are an absolute joy to behold. They're funny. There's maybe occasional moments with where you're kind of a little concerned about the old drunk stage Irishness going on, but it does seem to be mostly reined back. And again, lots of kind of crazy people jumping out of windows and, you know, just odd bits. And he really captures the wholeness of that character as well, the kind of the drunken buddy who wants to hang around and leech off his mate. But then the minute things start to go bad, turns on him and is immediately trying to get what little he has taken off him and be repossessed. And that, you know, there's no romanticism about that character, which I thought worked very well.
Yeah, and you're talking about the drunk Irishness there possibly being played to the hilt. You know, you're in a situation here that you're supposed to be in a Dublin tenement. Did you feel you were in Dublin, particularly with those lead characters? Because I will mention the other cast in a minute, who many of them are Irish, so I suppose the Dublin accent wouldn't cause as big a problem. What about the Dublinese quality of the leading characters, leading players?
Yeah, there was a bit of wondering, I can't lie. I think J. Smith Cameron did very well. Occasionally it went a little bit American, but actually that's, you know, that isn't so far from us that it was distracting. I think Mark Rylance was a sort of general sort of Dublin accent, which was sustained throughout, but wasn't a sort of particularly kind of working class Dublin accent that you would expect, but not distracting. You know, there were no howlers on the stage, at least.
Outside of that, and these are the predominantly Irish players that I'm speaking about, Aisling Cairns as Mary Boyle, Evan, I'm hoping saying his name right correctly, Evan Fitzgerald Doherty as Johnny Boyle, Ingrid Craigie as Mrs. Tancred, Anna Healy as Mrs. Maisie Madigan, and Chris Whalley, he of Young Offenders fame, as Charles Bentham, Sean Duggan and Leo Hannah, completing out the cast there as well. Any standout moments or non-standout moments within the supporting cast for you, Emer?
No, I mean, I thought they all did their job very well and gave very kind of beautifully tuned performances, but it was very hard for them to kind of go against Mark Rylance, who was playing in a completely different style to everyone else in the cast, who was kind of playing naturalism. And so I felt that a lot of the performance, a lot of good work, that when you were watching closely, you could see how attentive they were to the details of the characters, kind of got a bit lost. Yeah.
Does the play get lost in the midst of all of that then?
I felt like it wasn't the best showing of it, but I think the play itself holds up very well. I don't think it's dated. I know some people have said that it is, but I don't think so. And I think that story of a woman in desperate circumstances holding her family together in time of war is as relevant now as it was when it was written.
Now, you're not just going to the theatre these days, Emer. You've been busy yourself. You have a new book on the way and a short film that you have made. The city Changes Its Faces, a new novel coming out early next year, and a short film called A Very Short Film About Longing, which you wrote and directed. Tell me a little bit about the novel first, if you would.
Well, so it's been a couple of years since I had a novel out, and I finally got round to it, and it sort of follows characters from The Lesser Bohemians, my second novel, and it's set again in Camden in the 1990s. And it's been kind of a real pleasure to go back into that world again and to get back into fiction writing again.
And your short film then, one of the actors of the moment in there, John Alwyn, and Natalia Kostreva, and yes. Lashe Anderson. Impossible love affairs. Are there other kinds?
I mean, I hope not. I'm going to run out of material.
And Joe Alwyn, how did you secure his services here?
Oh, just very kindly. I think he liked my books. And we met up and we had a cup of coffee, and I was kind of looking for someone to write something for that was going to take me away from kind of young woman as a lead role. And so I decided to write it with him in mind. So he plays a kind of young school teacher stuck in an impossible love affair.
Oh, there you go. And sometimes if you ask, you get. I guess that's the lesson from that one. I'm going to finish up with a clip from the film, but thanks for being with us this evening, Eimear.
Thank you.
That's Eimear McBride. Let's listen to a clip from her new film, a very short film all about longing. And this is the aforementioned Joe Alwyn playing the character of Paul, and Lena played by Natalia Kortsvera. They're discussing their future.
What are you thinking about?
Which next week?
And your husband?
Packing our apartment up and what will happen when he moves in into this house.
And is it still what you want?
We've been married for 20 years.
It's not an answer.
It is.
So what have we been then?
Recess.
Recess? That's it.
Well, after 20 years, you also want a break.
Serious.
I know you are.
And there we go. That is Joe Alwyn as Paul and Natalia Kortsvera as Lena in Eimear McBride's film, a very short film about longing. The production of Juno and the Peacock that Eimear reviewed for us is tonight will run at the Gielgud Theatre until the 23rd of November. And Eimear's new novel, The City Changes Its Face, due out in February. In late 2020, as the arts world was slowly opening up after You Know What, filmmaker Donald Taylor Black was reading the Irish Arts Review, noticed a piece by Solomon Fine Art about an upcoming exhibition of works by sculptor John Behan. What particularly piqued Donald's attention was a note about how John had been working in migrant camps in Greece, giving drawing and sculpture workshops to volunteers and migrants. It started Donald on a journey that has become a film about the life and work of John Behan. It's called John Behan Odyssey. Film will be screened at Indie Cork this Thursday and at the Irish Film Institute in Dublin on Monday. Delighted to be joined in studio by Donald Taylor Black and sculptor John Behan. And of course, you can watch proceedings at this point if you so wish on rte.ie/arena. Donald, the reading of that Irish Arts Review, it wasn't suddenly you went, oh, this is an interesting guy, must find out more about him. I think you'd been a long time admirer of John's work.
Absolutely, yeah. We never actually met, but I was familiar with his work, and we had lots of mutual friends in common, including the late Jerry Daw, the poet who does feature in the film. John got to know him particularly when Jerry was teaching in Galway before he moved to Trinity and set up the Oscar Wilde Centre. But I think it's always when you're thinking of an idea for a documentary film, especially if it's biographical about a living person, it's always good to stop it being, as I heard someone say the other day, a Wikipedia type film, which starts off born in Sheriff Street in 1938 and then chronologically just going through the dates. So when there was something else, i.e. John's commitment to migrants and refugees, that just tipped the balance to me, and I thought now's the time to meet him and to hopefully raise the money and make a film about him.
Yeah, and indeed you don't start, while we do get the Sheriff Street stories and other great stories from your childhood, John, you start I was waiting, please tell me where that museum is. An extraordinary museum that you're walking into in Athens, the Acropolis Museum, isn't it?
Yes, it's the Acropolis Museum. And
That's the opening shot of you walking into that magnificent building.
Yeah, and all the art treasures in there that would take the eyes out of your head, as they did mine, you know. That was some experience. And I really enjoyed filming in Athens because for the first time I became aware of drone cameras and things like that. There's magnificent cinematography by Colm Hogan in that film. So I was amazed, and that experience of going up into the past to walk into the future at the far end, as far as I was concerned as an artist, was some experience.
And it also was it gave you a chance to talk about your own interest in mythology, kind of mythology as the ever-giving well, mythology of all kinds, Irish and Greek.
Yes, it was a meeting of two cultures, really, me as an Irish person, and then all the magnificent pieces of artwork from all eras of Greek culture, you know, there in front of you, and you ready to feed off that, you know. It's some experience, and once you're bitten by the Greek bug, I was there first in 1980, you never forget it, you know.
But you're possibly bitten by the mythology bug, but I think there was something, a more disturbing type of bite that came in more recent years.
Well, at that stage, yes, because in 2016, I just got fed up reading and hearing about the migrants and all the problems and so forth. And I said, I'm going to do something about it. What could I do as an artist was just to go out there and meet them and work with them as best I could and doing something creative with them. And I still have that impulse, and I'm still working on it. I have a show now coming up in the Solomon Gallery that has quite a few numbers of that particular subject matter. You know, it's to do with migrants, basically, why it happened and what can we do about it, and just in an artistic way, a cultural way, to do something permanent. I quote Auden often in this sense that he said, look at the trouble we have in the world, and the only thing is, he said, if we don't love each other, we'll cease to exist. And that's the problem in the world today, you know, as I see it. And art and culture is the antidote to all of that, creativity.
Indeed, one of the things that we see, Donald, and in the very eloquent way that John has put it there, we see John's connection with the young migrants in various camps and various organisations and projects that you visit in Greece. How difficult a situation is it when you're filming in somewhere like some of these migrant camps where they... Let's face it, the conditions are just about, in many cases, they're at a subhuman level, but they're struggling just to, you know, keep shelter and food going.
No, and to get access isn't easy, but also you know the director has a sort of, you know, has to look to his or her own ethics in terms of what you show, and if people are not living in the best circumstances and have psychological or whatever the pain, you want to also be aware of that and not feed you just using them. But we were also very pleased that the majority of the work that John had done before COVID, before I started filming him, was in a place called Camp Ilonas, which was closed down by the time we got there. But we got permission. To my amazement, we had a brilliant Greek fixer who'd worked with two Irish production companies on other projects before. And she, I think even to her own surprise, got permission from the relevant Greek ministry to allow us to go back to the camp that John had done the majority of his art classes. Mm. And it was very moving to be there because the place was a ruin. And then we had some archive footage of it, which just of a few years before, obviously. And we intercut that with John walking around and looking at it.
Yeah.
And then we filmed it a couple of other NGOs with slightly better conditions, where John, in one place called the Falsha Center, which was a small NGO founded by an American woman and an Irish woman, where John gave some art classes.
Yeah, Claire Campion and Colleen Bromberger.
That's right, that's right. And then we also went to a place called the
Cora Kitchen, is it?
Cora Kitchen,
Kitchen, maybe.
Yeah, where John was just really doing drawing and observing the people. And by the time we were there, a lot of the people who were guests or visitors to these NGOs were Greek themselves, not just from sub-Saharan Africa or whatever that had been maybe more the case when John had come in the first place, because the poverty in Greece, in Athens, was bad.
Yeah, I watched that particular scene with interest where, John, you are sketching the I think it's two women as they're cooking at a cooker. But I'm interested in those workshops that you give and the nature of the art practice for you when you're there as teacher, maybe isn't the right word, I don't facilitator, guide to people. What is for you is the difference between, or is there a difference between your general art practice and that type of work?
Well, it's a matter of communication and meeting people and trying to communicate with them. And also just putting a hand out on their shoulder and say, you're okay, you know, and I'm right beside you and behind you, you know, and just make yourself present. That means a lot to them, I discovered, you know. And the most important thing was, though, communication. And I did that through art practice, my own practice. It was very simple. There was nothing complicated. I didn't want to raise. There was no intellectual issues. And I met Turkish groups and all kinds of people. The Minister for Culture at that time was a lady whose name I can't remember, but she facilitated me very much in meeting different groups of people. And the stories that they told were amazing, you know, where they'd come from, how they got there. And that to me was inspiring, and it inspired my work and my commitment, you know. It made me further committed to doing something through art and cultural communications to show people that the world is not that simple. You know, it's just refugees. They're also human beings and they have aspirations to be a part of the human race, let's put it that way.
And that kind of essential humanity that is so evident in what you've just said, that is not something that has arrived in later years. It has been there from the very beginning, and some of the great archive that Donald and his team have uncovered is quite telling in that respect. I have a clip here from 1968, in fact, and the current affairs programme, 7 days, you're being interviewed in the Dublin graphics studio. And you had kind of got involved in graphics because you wanted your work to get out there to a wider audience.
Absolutely.
You're working as a lithographer.
Yeah.
And you're talking in this clip about the role of the arts in Ireland.
Usually the painter nowadays, I think the real painter or sculptor or artist, finds that he's working for a very small audience. This curtails his involvement, you know, with society, which I feel is a great, great loss all round. I think where this division between the artist and the people can be bridged is in places like Ballymun, a new housing development. I don't think that the corporation or the building authorities involved there have made any attempt to, say, landscape the area with sculptors. I think perhaps the corporation should have at least a half a dozen artists almost working for them full time, and they could advise them on such a project. And in doing this, they involve the artists into the community.
There you go. That's a very young and sprightly John Behan speaking in 1968.
Just about 30 years of age, yeah. I know.
Yeah, and what's interesting within older, that... So, sorry, John, go ahead.
I'm just a little older now.
Yeah, you've added a few in the meantime, right enough. But what's interesting, and this is, I think, it's there in another archive that you found as well, is that essential social aspect and community aspect to how John views the arts. It is the odyssey that you bring us on when talking about his work.
Absolutely. And I think, Sean, one of the interesting things about, and one of the impressive things about John Behan as a person, I don't want to embarrass him, but is that he's, throughout his career, he has been very consistent, both in the sort of commitment to social justice and also generally his work as an artist, his political views haven't really, they've developed and whatever, but it's a pretty straight line to that Odyssey in some respects. I don't mean in a boring way, but I think that's impressive. I mean, not that it's a bad thing to change or to change your views, but in John's case, he's not one of those people, and I think all the better for it.
Yeah, and very telling around John, some of the kind of the new formation or the formation of the New Arts Council in the mid-1970s, how important that was for you.
Yeah, that was during a coalition government. Liam Cosgrave was the Taoiseach at the time. And there had been a lot of agitation in the 60s. The independent artists and the Group 65. There was a whole generation of sculptors and painters who were advocating that art was for people. It wasn't just for an elite.
Yeah.
And there was a very strong James McKenna, Michael Caine, Breen Burke, Charles Cullen, a whole group of people were behind that movement and very active.
Yeah, and some great archive footage of various aspects of that.
They were on the front
well.
Pages of newspapers, yeah. You know. You don't see that nowadays.
The other thing, John, is it's interesting the kind of, I suppose, symbols and images within your artwork that have been there from the very beginning. The bull is hugely important. The film, in some ways, within your art practice, starts with a bull, and we have a bull at the very end of the film as well.
There's a poem by Seamus Heaney that reminds me of it very much, called The Outlaw, where he takes a bull, Seamus himself takes a cow to a bull on a nearby farm, and the farmer charges, I think his name is Kelly, he charges a fiver for the cow to be serviced by his scrub bull. And that was the way things were done in the country in those days. But when I was very young, my people came from County Leash. They were farmers, you know. My grandfather was a farmer and his sons worked on the farm. And one day I was taken with a cow over to Hipwells, and the cow was serviced by the bull. And I was about 7 or 8 years of age. And this opened my eyes instinctively to something that was much bigger than I was and much huger. It was all kinds of things. It confused me and it also gave me a huge shock, you know. And I became interested in bulls and all of that thing afterwards. Then mythology entered into Tom Bocool and all of that.
Yeah, and you moved
that
west.
That came from that experience.
Yeah. And you moved west. You moved over to Galway, and there was quite kind of artistic...
There was a big community of artists there, practising artists or working, you know.
The other thing, the other aspect that Donald and the team, I think, explore very well is the whole idea of the famineship, the development of that famineship image within your body of work. It's been hugely important.
Yeah, well, Tom Murphy's play Famine was one of the inspirations for that. Liam O'Flaherty's book called Famine, I think, as well. And I'd been thinking about that for years since I was a kid. The famine, it really struck me when I was very young. And my uncles used to talk about it because my grandfather, John Bean as well, known as Black Jack, he was some character. But he was born in 1852, which officially was the last year of the famine. And I knew that man, and I spoke to him, and he lived to be nearly 100, you know. So I had some connection with it, you know, direct connection, if you like.
And I guess
that gave me the inspiration.
And that connection is there, those famine ships, that history that you're telling us, is there with today's migrants.
Absolutely. Sure, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, different... But the horrible thing about nowadays is Camus said one time, and this law has been broken every day, this kind of ethic. He said that there is no philosophy worth the spilling of one drop of a child's blood. And I firmly believe in that.
Yeah.
And it's horrible what's going on today. And artists should become much more involved than they are. I mean, it's no good decorating something, you know. You've got to be committed. Like Picasso said, you must attack.
One final thing. There was an image that really struck me, and I don't know whether it was what it felt like for you. At one point, Donald brings you to your sister's house in Merino, and she is Mary, is her
name? Mary,
yeah. Mary. Mary produces this old drawing that she found. She kind of said, you took everything else out of the house, but I found this. And it's a drawing you made maybe in your teens, maybe even...
Yeah,
your...
early teens. I was 13, 14, 15, around then, yeah.
Of your mother.
Yeah.
Looking at that as the grown professional artist, John Behan, what was that set of emotions?
I was very attached to my mother because she was a Donegal woman and a Gaelic speaker, came from a family that didn't speak English at all. They could hardly speak English. But she was very encouraging to me as a young kid, you know. My father wasn't too happy when I told him I wanted to be an artist. But my mother never really discouraged me, you know. And I always have that as a memory and a very encouraging memory to my whole aspect of life. And I used to do drawings of the family when I was a young kid, like, you know, teenager. And we still have a few of them. They remind me of Van Gogh or somebody like that, you know, starting out, not knowing where you're going to end up, you know. But I've ended up as a sculptor.
Yeah, well, you've ended up... You are currently a sculptor. Let's not use the word ended up. Because I think there's probably a bit more on this odyssey of yours. Thanks to both of you so much for coming in this evening. That is John Behan and Donald Taylor Black, the director of the documentary we've been speaking about. The screening of John Behan Odyssey at the Irish Film Institute Monday the 14th of October will be followed by a Q&A. More information of that at ifi.ie. The film will also be screened this Thursday at the Arc Cinema in Cork, and that's part of the Indie Cork Festival. And you can find out full details about that on arccinema.ie. Ten Rillington Place, Notting Hill, was a notorious address in 1950s London, home to the serial killer John Reginald Christie, and site of many of his crimes. It became a sensation overnight when the bodies of three women were found buried in its walls in 1953. For a perpetrator of grisly murders, Christie cut a shockingly banal figure when he was finally caught. Nothing like the Jack the Ripper type people may have expected. Kate Summerscale, best known as the award-winning author of Suspicions of Mr. Whitcher, a true crime account of a Victorian murder. In her latest book, The Peep Show, The Murders at 10 Rillington Place, she turns her gaze on Christie and his victims and post-war Britain. Declan Burke has been reading the book for us and he's with me in the studio now. What was it about this particular set of murders at 10 Rillington Place in the 1950s that so gripped the public's imagination at that time, Declan?
Well, I mean, I think you've touched on a couple of the aspects in your intro, Sean. So when the bodies were discovered, that grim body-ridden house, as it was described in court, it was as a result of a renovation. They were just pulling down the wallpaper to, you know, it was the ordinariness of the discovery, and they found three bodies stuffed into the wall. I mean, that's kind of shocking in itself. And then shortly afterwards, when the police got involved, they pulled up the floorboards and discovered Reg Christie's wife stuffed under the floorboards again. Doubly shocking. The ordinariness of Notting Hill itself, which was at the time a rather scruffy neighbourhood suburb of London, but as you said, not the kind of place that we're expecting the latest Jack the Ripper to leap from. So, but ultimately, when Reg Christie is found, there's a manhunt once they realise that he is very likely the culprit. He's caught after a few days, and once they see the photographs and once they hear his own testimony, this shockingly ordinary and nondescript, these are quotes, person, he was everything that the British person, gentleman, should be. You know, he was quiet, he was reserved, he was kind to his neighbours. He had fought in the First World War. He had served in the War Reserve Police in the Second War. He was one of our own, as they would say. Mm. If he was capable of these absolutely heinous crimes, you know, where was Britain going? So it was a whole question about Britain rather than just who was this person who committed these crimes.
And with a warning that, you know, what is described in the book and what happened in and around these murders is very, very difficult in places. How forthright is Kate Summerscale in describing what happened to us, And how important is it that she does that?
She's too good a writer to flinch at the difficult and challenging material that you're alluding to. Reg Christie is a serial murderer. He gassed his victims before strangling them. Horrific murders. To avoid the details will be to patronise the reader and also, I think, dishonour the victims to a certain extent. So she doesn't try to gloss over the details. Having said that, this is not a book. There's certainly no gratuitous exploration of the violence and the murder and the way in which the murders are subsequent committed
to the gassing and the tying up and whatever awful tortures went on there. There were also sexual assaults, rapes.
There was, and the police were unable to establish whether they took place before or after. The women were dead, which adds another dimension of horror to the murders. And as well as that, Sean, we will talk about the Timothy Evans case. I'm sure there was a miscarriage of justice. But, you know, his victims ranged in age from middle-aged women right down to a 13-month-old baby. I mean, this was an absolutely appalling human being.
Yes, because subsequent to the Reddington Street discoveries, it expanded out from there, and in fact there are those who would say there are still other murders that have never been found.
Well, certainly the case that Kate Summerscale explores in this book. So Timothy Evans had been convicted and had been hanged for the murder of his wife Beryl and their 13-month-old baby. Now, the Evans, they lived in a flat at 10 Rillington Place as well. They were neighbours of the Christies. And when Timothy Evans was arrested for the murder of his wife, She and the baby were found in a wash house out in the backyard. He initially said that Reg Christie was the one responsible. And then he changed his mind and gave a different testimony to the police and said that he had committed the crimes, which was very strange, very, very bizarre. The reality, according to the book, is that Timothy Evans did want to get rid of his wife, but that Christie had volunteered to take care, quote unquote, of the situation. Again, these are not the actions of anything that could be remotely described as a normal human being.
So we have this fairly rumpledy-thump suburb, as Notting Hill would have been at that time. We have this most ordinary of ordinary men committing these outrageous and horrible acts. Summerscale places all of this very carefully in post-war Britain, and not explains it away, but certainly gives that context has been hugely important.
That word context is crucially important to Kate Summerscale. So there's a wonderful portrait of London that runs in tandem with the story of Reg Christie in this book. You know, the London that we see, it's still effectively a bomb site. You know, England is, or Britain is still in a depression. It is entering, quote unquote, a brutish new era, according to the tabloid press. That has a lot to do with, you know, many young men having gone off to fight a war and been coerced by the, you know, the experience, coming back and finding that they had very little prospects in the Britain they had left behind. During the war, as we all know, a lot of women had got financial and social independence because they went out and joined the labour force. Now, the authorities are trying to push them back into the homes, whether they want to go or not, because they need, you know, jobs for the men and so forth. So as a result, young men and women are intermingling socially to an extent that they probably would never have done before. And this is something that Reg Christie really takes advantage of, this ability to kind of flit through the crowds and engage on a one-on-one with young women. Also, during the war, the number of sex workers had spiked. And this was something that continued on after the war. And a number, most, in fact, of Reg Christie's victims were prostitutes. But again, there was more access for him. This allowed him to. And also, Kate Summerscale relies heavily in terms of her research on a report that was commissioned in the late 1950s about attitudes towards sex workers. And contempt and disdain would be, you know, would feature largely in terms of how they were treated, and particularly when it came to, you know, a prostitute reporting violence against herself or one of her. We can only imagine how well or thoroughly those would have been investigated by the police. And racism is also a factor here. because there was a lot of Caribbean immigrants arriving in the post-war years. And Notting Hill was one of the areas in which, and what we discover is that Reg Christie is just a naked racist. And that adds entirely to the friction that occurs in Ten Willington.
Yeah, how does that, how does the dark side of Christie, how does that come out in the book?
It comes out through his own testimony to a certain extent, because once he is caught and arrested and he is arraigned, his legal team, having looked at the appalling evidence, they want him to claim insanity and try to get him off, because we have to remember that capital punishment was still in force at the time. That's his only hope, to claim that you're insane. So he was encouraged to give interviews to his legal team to be debriefed on his murder. So that we start to hear Christie's own voice and his perception of himself and his actions and so forth in his own words, these bank clerk phrases, yeah, as they're reported. And the level of self-delusion that comes across is absolutely gobsmacking. If it was a novel, Sean, you know, you'd say to the author, you might want to tighten up that character.
Yeah, and I'll come back in a minute to the non-fiction aspect of it and the treatment of these type of topics in, I suppose, what is true crime.
Sure.
That's what the genre is here. But you mentioned the novel there, and there are two other characters, a Harry Proctor and Fryn Tennyson, Jesse, perhaps. These are characters, as you put it, I think yourself, Declan, as opposed to people who were around at the time. There's a sense that Summerscale has the eye of a novelist in her non-fiction writing.
There's no doubt about that. I mean, the book itself is just absolutely littered with these delicious details of its time and place, which really adds to the experience. But she also, what she does, these two characters are people, as we should call them. So Harry Proctor was the lead investigative reporter with the Sunday Pictorial at the time, which was one of the biggest Sunday tabloids. And Fryn Tennyson Jesse, she was a mystery novelist who also wrote, contributed to notable British trials. So Kate Summerscale is availing of herself of these two sources primarily because they bring different aspects of storytelling to the reportage of the Reg Christie trial.
But coming back to that aspect, that here we are with these, you know, previously it was the Victorian murders and that kind of, that feels, well, that's far away. That's far enough away for us to be able to look at it. This is relatively recent. Certainly, you know, within the last 100 years, there are people alive who will remember the details.
Living memory, absolutely.
Yeah, of those murders. Does Summerscale address the fact that she is, entertainment is too strong a word, but that she is writing about these victims in a book that she calls The Peep Show?
I certainly don't think she is, shall we say, abusing the victim's memory for the sake of entertainment. I know that's not the question you're asking me, of course. And this is a true crime book that is being bought for readers to, you know, peruse and so forth. She isn't presenting entertainment, Sean. I think she's certainly talking about the Reg Christie murder as the kind of first post-war precursor of what was come, and that it was, you know, the kind of canary in the coal mine. There's no doubt about that.
And as is often the case in these stories, we get a great profile of the perpetrator of the crimes. How much do we find out about the victims?
She does do her research, and you know, even when the 1953 murders happened, and that was horrible enough, what they then discovered was he had actually killed twice. Reg Christie had killed twice during the Second War while operating as a policeman. And Kate Summerscale goes to great efforts to report on how difficult it was for the authorities at the time because some of these bodies, if it was found in an abandoned building, was this person killed by a bomb? Was it, you know, yeah, whatever? And she goes through the huge efforts that the authorities made at the time and afterwards. And yes, she follows through on the victims themselves. Now, some of the victims, like, for example, Ethel Crystal, is married to Reg Christie. Yeah. So her story is intertwined. So, she gives the victims their due. There's absolutely no doubt about that.
I don't know if a recommendation is the right word to ask, but is this, if you like this genre, is this a good...
Well, I don't, Sean. I don't read true crime, but this is brilliant. This is one of the best books I've read all year. It's absolutely superb.
There you go. From a non-true crime reader, that is Declan Burke talking to us about The Peep Show, The Murders at 10 Riddington Place by Kate Summerskill, which is published by Bloomsbury. And that is our lot for this Tuesday evening. Paula Shields researched. Dolly Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Sound supervision this evening was by Mark Dwyer. And tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. I won't be with you tomorrow night. Back with you on Thursday as usual. Kay will be with you in the seat tomorrow. And John Creedon will be with you after the 8 o'clock news.